Hey, hello. I'm going to turn my camera off. Welcome, everybody. Today's Practicing Nectar of the Path webinar with senior instructors Miosh Kelly and Edwin Kelly. And today is Tuesday, October 9, 2018. Welcome.
Thank you. So I'm really happy to be here with everyone today. Nectar of the Path to me is, how to say, it's a feels like it just through each part that we go through touches on the essence of meditation over and over again in a way that, is a complete practice. What I love too is how, it holds a simplicity I really resonate with, which for, not doing so well in the complex world, it really is helpful. And it feels like a practice that one can actually keep up in one's daily life. That when we have time, we can do it for extended periods and it's all there. Or when the days are much shorter, we're still touching into the essential points as we practice. So, I just have an immense amount of gratitude that Mingyur Rinpoche did come out with this practice for us. And I today really look forward to hearing from you how this practice is working for you and any stumbling blocks, questions. But I just feel there's so much benefit from doing this particular practice. So, Edwin, I don't know if you have a few words to share.
Not much to add to that. I think you covered it all pretty well. I just realized as you were talking that I actually have the original handwritten text somewhere in a file beside me here that Rinpoche wrote on the back of a little notepad from a hotel. You know, one of those little message pads you pick up from a hotel room. And I was rummaging around here to see if I could find it, but I can't find it off the top of my head. So I was going to show it. But it's such a beautiful, poetic and succinct practice, and it contains everything. We are really, really fortunate to have this Nectar of the Path. Actually, it's a pearl, it's a gem, from Mingyur Rinpoche, and we have Cortland Dahl to thank because he really, really is. He prevailed upon Rinpoche in no uncertain terms before he went on retreat, requesting that he write this practice, as a way to stay connected to him while he was gone for all those years. So, and it's become such a core and central part of what we offer. So, or what, the Thergai Path of Liberation. So, just wanting to, exude a little appreciation. So, yeah, thanks for joining us. It's wonderful to have you here. I'm going to continue to rummage around in my drawers here, see if I can find it.
Okay, just one thing that came to mind as you were saying that, Edwin, was that this to me really helps me bring alive the sense of lineage, and that what we're doing is finding the essence that lands in the modern day world that really helps us to be liberated. And again, just as Edwin's expressing, I have complete gratitude for this. So yeah. Well, Edwin's rummaging. Maybe we can. Are you almost? Did you find it?
No, it might be in one I've already got out. I just need to look a little closer.
Okay. Well, maybe
Keep
we can
going. Keep
open
going.
it up for questions here. Questions, comments, and I'd love. Yeah, I'm really interested. Is this practice alive for you? Is it working?
So I just want to invite people to raise their virtual hand. Just click on the hand icon. But maybe for openers, we've had some questions that have already been submitted, and we have a lot of general practice questions, but we also have some Nectar of the Path specific questions, and maybe we can start with that. And so Chris is asking, which opening and closing dedication prayers do you highly recommend as part of Nectar of the Path?
Well, when we do Nectar of the Path, we can, how to say, bookend it with the daily chants. And so that can vary depending on how much time you have, but that refuge in bodhicitta, the Four Immeasurables, and if you have time, the Kagyu lineage prayer, And at the end, the full dedication. So, you know, given that, like when we start doing Nectar of the Path, we're already into the four thoughts as we begin. That's where I think a most important piece is to do refuge and bodhicitta before one begins Nectar of the Path.
Okay, very good, very clear. And I'm going to go over to Tom now, who has a live question. Tom Gallagher, if you could just unmute yourself, Tom, and there you go.
Hi, Miocean. Hi, Edwin, everybody.
Hi, Tom.
I can only be on this for a little while because of another commitment, but this has been my daily practice for over 2 years.
Okay.
I do it probably, at least 6 days a week, maybe, and the goal is every day, every week. And I do just what you described. I do the invocation prayer. I do the Kagyu lineage as well. And I was curious, I've poked Cortland a couple of times on alternative translations or interpretations. Maybe this is already on the website. Is there any way to get a little bit more texture in some of the translation that lends more of a flavor to the Tibetan? Maybe not asking it very clearly, but there are places, for example, where Rinpoche uses Dharmakaya, talks about the essence of thought being Dharmakaya. I translate that in my own recitation as emptiness, to make it a little bit more westernized. And I just wonder if there's a way to dig more deeply into some of the translations.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. The whole realm of translation is really Cotland's world. Heaven forbid that I say anything that contradicts what he might say.
No, I'm joking. You're wrong.
And he has a team of people to support him, and that are within Toga folks that understand Tibetan, and people outside his connections. And so I know a lot of thought, and I actually had some conversations with him, particularly there's a few sections within the Nectar of the Path where he struggled with finding the right words, and there was sort of a lot of thought went into it. But with regard to words like Dharmakaya, the problem is that there is no English translation of Dharmakaya, and that's true for a lot of these Sanskrit
words. Yes. Yeah.
The whole body of three kayas or four kayas, that whole thing. I think a lot of translators have really come to the conclusion that some terms like that are better left in Sanskrit, and that it's your journey on the path to awaken within yourself the understanding of the doctrine of the three kayas, because it is so critical and essential or central to the Vajrayana practice on some level. I know there's another question here about Vaishadhara, primordial Buddha, and a lot of that sort of stuff is really, really subtle. I suggest you just source as much information as you can from various sources, read different books, kind of inform your brain as much as you can from various sources. And if you're ever fortunate enough to be in the presence of Mingal Rinpoche in retreat, make sure you ask him the question, because then you will get an explanation of Dharmakaya or Vajradhara or whatever. That'll be far better than anything I could ever give you.
Well, thank you very much for that. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate the question, because it is like our own willingness to keep these words alive, the sense of inquiry, and really looking in our own experience that will help broaden it out.
Yep, great. Thank you.
So Jane had asked the question, as you know, about the guru, about guru yoga and how to imagine Vajradhara as a primordial Buddha. And she's also asking, am I eligible for guru yoga study having received pointing out instructions from Kempo Kunga?
Yes.
So, you know, I'm going to back up a little bit. Way back when, I don't know, it's got to be like nearly 20 years ago, shortly after one of the first teachings I had from Ingen Rinpoche was a retreat Yoshi and I did in Crestone with him, 2000, 2001 or two or something. And what really struck me about that retreat was that he really emphasized our practice has five elements that if you do in any practice session, that's it. Refuge, bodhicitta, guru yoga, main practice, dedication. And the main practice, fill in the blank. You can do whatever. And so from the Vajrayana perspective, and the way Mingo Rinpoche illustrated or explained it, he is basically saying we should, or any practice session should have those five elements in it. So guru yoga is just so central to Vajrayana. You know, it's interesting that when you look at the Nundro sequence, and if you do it sequentially, then refuge, bodhicitta, Vajrasattva, mandala offering, and then you get to guru yoga. So there might be a sense that it's linear or that it's something that you get to later on. But guru, the connection to the guru is paramount to Vajrayana Buddhism. And to go through the visualizations or the chanting of that's in the nectar of the path, any way you do the guru yoga. So once you've received the transmission for the nectar of the path, which you would get at any retreat with Kempo Kungo or any path liberation retreat with Kempo Kungo or Mingo Rinpoche, and once you've had some brief instructions about it, and you've had an empowerment, in most instances it would be Vajrasattva, but it could be an empowerment of any sort with anybody. So there's those three elements. There's the Wong in Tibetan, which is the empowerment, the Lung, which is the reading transmission of the text, and the Tree, which is some teachings about some element of it. Once you've had those three transmissions, and of course, for the Nectar of Path or these teachings also comes with pointing out instructions from either Mingo Rinpoche or Kempo Kungo or some other qualified Lama. Once you've got all those components, you're empowered, entitled, or you have all the necessary transmissions to do the complete practice, everything that's in Nectar of the Path. I don't know whether you have anything more to add to that, Myoshin.
Yeah, I mean, I still would like to give the encouragement to go through Nectar of the Path in the way that it's laid out in the levels, because I think that that's really valuable to not skip over any of the pieces. But you do find that guru yoga, in a sense, comes in with refuge. And certainly the exploration, we want to bring that to life for us. And we're getting echo here for some reason. And so, yes, finding the way that does come to life for us is really important. But if you are looking at doing the path of liberation, then I would encourage you to go step by step through it as well.
Yes. And so to perhaps address specifically your question about Vajradhara. So as I understand Vajradhara, he's considered to be like the primordial Buddha. And someone explained it to me once in a way that I found very helpful. You know, so the understanding is we've been in samsara since beginningless time, whenever that started. And, but Vajradhara, unlike us, didn't mistake appearance as objects and self as other, self and other, and therefore was not conflicted or confused with ignorance like we all are here and find ourselves in samsara. Vajradhara was fortunate enough to have the wisdom to not fall into samsara. And remained in Nirvana, and so that's the sense of the primordial Buddha. In the Nyingma tradition, you have Samantabhadra, and Samantabhadra is similarly a primordial Buddha. And by no coincidence, both Samantabhadra and Vajradhara are blue, because there's the color of the Dhammakaya. You know, if you live in Colorado or somewhere in the mountains or the Midwest where the sky is always really, if you have one of those days where the sky is perfectly blue, look up at the sky and you're looking at Vajradhara. So that's the sense of it. You know, he represents the Namakaya. He represents the primordial, non-conceptual, non-disturbed manifestation of Buddha nature. And so, you know, well, and the other significance in terms of Mahamudra is that Talopa received the Mahamudra teachings in a transmission from Vajradhara. So it was one of those mind transmissions, mind termers kind of things. And so from Vajradhara to Talopa, Naropa, Mapa, Milarepa, Gompopa, the Kamapas, etc., which is the supplication to that's the lineage, the supplication to the Dakpo Kagyu. And so Vajradhara has a primary place, like he's in the middle of the refuge tree. He has a primary place in the center of the lineage of the Kagyu lineage and Mahamudra. I don't know if that was sufficient, Jane. If you have any, if you want to raise your hand and ask more about it, or anybody else.
So I just have a couple of practical things to add to that. One is, you know, with the Guru Yoga, Rinpoche also talks about, or whatever Buddha you connect with. So it can be Vajradhara. And even if we're not familiar with Vajradhara, but we get the sense of enlightened qualities and presence, and we could, you know, then it's really helpful to get a picture of some sort. You know, at programs, I think we often give out Vajradhara pictures. And that just helps, you know, because this is something that we haven't grown up with, these images around us. So if we have some image, some people buy a tanka, you know, that we can look to, that helps to evoke these qualities, and, you know, has a form that helps us to get in touch with these qualities, that's really useful. But also, you know, I know for some people, it's really important, like, to use white Tara, or some other Buddha. So it's really finding that visual form that helps us to connect with the enlightened qualities.
And just looking at your question again, Jane, please explain Guru Yoga. Well, there's a lot more to Guru Yoga than what we just mentioned. But the wonderful thing about Nectar of the Path is that it has both the relative and the absolute Guru Yoga. So we begin with the relative, which is establishing this connection relationship between ourselves and the Guru, using Vajradhara or the Buddha or any Buddha as a representation of the Guru. And, you know, we set up that and supplicate in that way. But then the ultimate Guru Yoga is the Buddha nature within your own mind. And I don't have the Nectar of the Path in front of me, but it's very clear that the last stanza of the Guru Yoga section is the absolute Guru Yoga. And so it's nearly like the relative Guru Yoga is a way to connect to the Guru. And we conclude by dissolving the mind of the Guru into our own mind, and that is the connection to the absolute Guru Yoga, which is the Buddha nature within us.
I'm going to unmute Jane because she said she wanted to add something to this. So Jane, you're live right now.
Hi, thank you very much, Myoshin and Edwin. You answered the question beautifully. And I think, Myoshin, to your point, having a visual for me, it really helps. And Edwin, when you were speaking about the spaciousness of sky, the blue helps me visualize, because I wanted to understand more about imagining in my mind. And so I think I'll look for that. And I have been practicing Nectar of the Path step by step. The one I haven't hit upon yet was the Guru Yoga. It was really foreign to me. But listening to you explain it, and also reading the glossary of Mingyur Rinpoche's book, Turning Confusion into Clarity, actually gives great definitions. So that also supported. But I'll go back and re-listen to what you said and go further. And it really clarified. Thank you.
Yes. So turning confusion into clarity, and also if you have or don't or can get your hands on a copy of the video material that Mingo Rinpoche recorded for doing Nundro practice, there's a whole section on Guru Yoga in there is really detailed and really wonderful. So, yeah.
That's great. On Vajrayana online, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, so I subscribe to that, and I've been doing Nectar of the Path, and then I've been doing the Six Paramitas, which was absolutely fantastic, and now I'm doing Nature of Mind, which I really enjoy that too. So I'm kind of going in the circular motion, but I am sticking with Nectar, but I'm not practicing every day as I was, as I'm doing some of the other practices. But I think I'm going to be moving into Guru Yoga now, so thank you.
Okay.
Great.
Thank you, and I'm going to unmute Molly right now. Molly Swisher, go ahead, Molly, just unmute yourself.
Okay, hi you guys, nice to see Molly. You.
Hi Molly.
So I just have sort of a mechanical question or two. It goes about Nectar. It goes back to the question about refuge and bodhicitta, firstly, which is, So I have added the refuge in bodhicitta from the daily practice in the beginning before I start Nectar. But then I've also, refuge in bodhicitta are buried within the practice as well. Mm-hmm. So I've had this question of if it's within the practice, why do we start out with it? We're kind of doing it twice. Not that it's a bad thing, but I'm just curious about that.
I know, I had the same question.
And then
I guess the risk is that you do too much refuge and bodhicitta practice. I don't know what the consequences of doing too much of that are, though.
Actually, so that I did get a response. I did get a response.
Sorry.
When I asked the question.
That was a joke.
When I asked the question, it is that we are doing the reflections, the four thoughts. Yes. And when we do a complete practice, it's like having everything within, the kind of the seal of a complete practice. And so that begins with refuge and bodhicitta and ends with dedication. And uh-huh. So it's to bring that part into what we can actually dedicate at the end of our practice.
That makes sense. Thank you. And then one other question that is probably really dumb, but it's still a question. So at the end of the refuge in bodhicitta that's within Nectar of the Path, the last line is, I will now practice the path. And then the next thing is Guru Yoga. But I'm uncertain. After I will now practice the path, it's always this kind of cognitive disconnect because, like, I'm already practicing.
Yes.
So what does that mean? And do I pause there for Nature of Mind, or what? What's that all about?
So I understand that last line is part of the two-line stanza that begins by saying, in order to bring all beings to the state of omniscient Buddhahood, I will now practice the path. And so that is the bodhicitta element of the Nectar of the Path. May my generosity and other virtuous deeds lead to the welfare of all beings, or Buddhahood for all beings, is the bodhicitta part of the daily chant. And it's really interesting to me because those two lines in Nectar of the Path were transformative in my mind, in my practice, for the understanding of bodhicitta. It was all of a sudden, it was like, in order to bring all beings, so every day when I do that, when I sit, I say those lines. And it's kind of like I'm sitting, in order to bring all beings to the state of omniscient Buddha, I will now practice the path. It's kind of like, it's the intention. It's tapping into bodhicitta that this is why I'm sitting here on the cushion. This is my purpose. So I found that really helpful to understand it in that light.
Yeah, it's really the application piece. And I think we can really dig into the application piece because it's on one sense, we can have these words, but to know that in order to really aspire for this, that I have to do my work. And I have to do my work, not just in this moment, but I really have to put myself on the path.
Throughout the day, throughout your life. So that's referring to practicing all the time mentally, you know, always bringing these bodhicitta to your all of your actions throughout your day.
Yeah, it's calling ourselves to accountability. Yeah.
Yeah, it's setting that intention. Okay, great. That's great. Thank you. Oh, well, and do we just go right into Guru Yoga after that, or is that a place to pause?
That's a place we can pause for reflection.
Okay.
You know, these reflection periods to me are what helps to bring it to life, to open it up, you know, just as all these questions do. We open it up in our own experience to make it meaningful so that we aren't just sitting in front of a text rotely reciting words that we like, but, you know, it's to give depth and meaning and be able to engage our hearts in this. And that, of course, is done, you know, it's like when we do the reflections, reflecting for a bit and resting and then, you know, bringing to mind the contemplation again and seeing if it opens up further.
Great. Thank you very much. That helps a lot.
Okay.
Thanks,
Molly. We have a nectar practice question just now written in by Jesse. His microphone's not working. So he can't ask it live. And he says, there are no instructions for how to proceed through the teachings in level 2 time-wise as there were in the 4 thoughts, i.e. 25 days for each. Do we go through all the teachings early on, or is it best to work our way through them slowly so we can proceed through the meaning of refuge, inner and outer refuge, and so on at our own pace?
Actually, there should be. I'm not sure whether you've got the recent handbook, but it does very specifically break down the refuge for you. So if you are on Vajrayana online and can go into where you get the handbook, that should give you the information that you need. And if you're not on Vajrayana online, just let us know and we can make sure you get the most current handbook because it does have the breakdown.
Thank you. I'm going to unmute Karen Keep. Hi, Karen.
Hi there.
How are
you guys? Hi, great to see you both.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this webinar. Nectar is, like you both have said, just an amazing practice. I used to only do it like in the evenings. I love doing it at the end of the day when I was working more on Nundro, but now I'm incorporating my nature of mind practice in with it. And it's just fantastic. So I hope I can word this clearly enough, in the Guru Yoga section, of course. So when we're saying Lama Keno, I'm trying to understand sort of what we're asking. We're saying, think of me. So we're imagining our guru thinking of us. Is that the idea? And the idea is, it's just, I'm throwing this out there, that because the guru has pure perception, and when the guru sees even those of us who aren't enlightened, he still sees us as enlightened because that is our basic nature. And so through that sort of imaginating, we begin to then also get accustomed to thinking of ourselves and touching in with that authentic Buddha nature, or tell me what I'm supposed to be doing there. I just wanted to throw out what I was thinking so you could help me. Thank you.
Do you want to go for it, Edwin?
You know, I couldn't find anything about what you just said, Karen, that I would disagree with. I think you're spot on the money. I've heard words like supplication to the guru, you know, what we're, the thing about Guru Yoga is that the Guru is alive. He's here. We have a connection. And if we're fortunate, we can reconnect in this life with the Guru, you know, more as often as we are able to. And so it's, there's this karmic kind of thing where we're connected as student and teacher. And the sub, this particular supplication is when we're separated, where we don't have the fortunate circumstances to be in the presence of the Guru, or even to do it in the presence of the Guru. So it invokes all of the karmic connection, and in a visualization that's meant to strengthen this connection to our Guru. You know, he's the source of refuge. He's the source of the empowerments, the transmissions. He's the source of the pointing out instructions and so forth. So all of that karmic connection is invoked in this supplication to the Guru to remember me, to don't abandon me. So we're actually asking, you know, please Dharma, don't abandon me. Please nature of mind, don't abandon me, because the Guru is a symbol for all of that. So and there's this really deep heartfelt yearning to maintain that connection in Guru Yoga, all of which is important to maintain this connection, recognition to our own Buddha nature. Did I say that right, Miyoshin?
The last part totally connected with my own experience, that sense of yearning and not wanting to be abandoned until I have totally recognized my nature of mind. I think you said it well. Yeah.
Yeah, Edwin, thank you. That, the yearning part, I get that definitely. And the explanation of the karmic connection makes a lot of sense now to me also. So I would have another question, but I'm going to give others time. If we have time, maybe we could go into the next stanza of the liturgy that has, and my question has to do with your minds merge indivisibly. So maybe if we have time, or if anybody else is interested in hearing about that, you guys could kind of touch on that. I'll go off now. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Karen. Nice to hear you.
So, Edwin, would you like to continue with that, or should we move on? We have about five or six.
I don't know. We can get to it. You know, I think Mingyur Rinpoche said this somewhere this summer in teachings I was with him. You know, we have this whole thing about, you know, become one with the whatever and the oneness and the separation. The best analogy that I have heard repeated a number of times recently is like our mind is like a cup in space, and the Guru's mind is like a cup in space. We all, our own individuality is defined by the container our consciousness is in. But the Dharmakaya, the vast consciousness, includes all these cups. And so when we become one, or when the minds meld inseparably, it's like the cup is broken. And I don't know, somehow or other, when I got that, it was like, whoa, yes, you know, the space in the cup and the space outside the cup are only defined as separate because of the cups there. And when the identity of the individual dissolves or passes away and the cup is broken, then there is no separation between the outer and the inner, the Guru and the disciple, the Dharmakaya and consciousness. So that's how it kind of made sense to me.
That's a great visualization. Thank you so very much. I'll imagine all these cups out there in the sky.
And then,
that's super helpful.
Dissolve.
Yeah, absolutely. Back into the Dharmakaya, the blue spacious sky. Thank you. You guys, thank you.
The Colorado sky. We were just in Colorado on retreat for a month. So quite a bit.
Yep. I've got that out here. Thank you both.
Thanks.
I ditto that. That was an amazing analogy. Thank you for that. I just wanted to point out to Jesse that our good friend Max has put the link on Vajrayana Online for the Level 2 Practicing Nectar of the Path page. So if you just look in the question box there, you can just copy that link, put it in your browser when you're on TierGuard Learning, and you'll go right to the Level 2 Practice page for Nectar.
Thank you.
Ryan is asking, can you suggest practices to help receive compassion and the bodhicitta of others?
Your turn, Miyoshin.
Actually, we talked about this, and you had one good response, and I have a very different. So you go ahead first.
I can't remember what I said. You go first. I'll try and remember what I said.
Okay. So when I read this question, which I think is a great question, I think for me, it comes down to being able to be with the way that we close our hearts, the ways that we shut down, the ways that we can't receive when they happen, and being inclusive of that within our practice without needing to judge that. You know, this is what's turning up. And this is what we do in practice, is really look at what obscures our nature. And these places where we can't receive, that is a great place to just be with, allow. And, you know, we can use any level of practice that we have been learning from Mingyur Rinpoche to inquire in these places. Like sometimes just being able to be with, or to know the nature of the feelings if we're doing nature of mind practice. Or, you know, sometimes we might be using some level of inquiry, you know, when we feel our hearts closing down, what's the perception here? You know, what's the perception that is binding the heart in this moment? Or is there some assumption that we're making? So we're really looking a little bit more analytically into the experience with a non-judging mind, just to see, and to see how we can include this, rather than to think that we're bad, we're wrong, we should do something different. But, you know, we all have places where we shut down, and being tender in these spots where we shut down, and inclusive. So that was one piece that came to mind for me with the question.
You're going to have to remind me what I said. I've totally forgotten.
I think it was more around, if I remember right, please correct it or pick it up. It was around how when you start to see basic goodness in yourself and you start to look for it in others.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, this has come up for me quite a bit lately. You know, as a practice, particularly for level 2, loving kindness and compassion practice, you know, we sometimes think that it's so much about developing these or recognizing these characteristics in ourselves. But, you know, the understanding is that all living beings have Buddha nature. So not only should we be able to recognize the manifestation of Buddha nature in ourselves, we should also be able to recognize the manifestation of Buddha nature in others. And it will manifest as compassion and as bodhicitta and as caring, kind, loving, expressions of kindness and compassion in others. And I have found it a really helpful practice to just tune into that, you know, when I go somewhere. And it can be something really simple and mundane. You know, I bet pretty much you go to a major building somewhere and there's a number of people coming in the main entrance. You can be pretty assured that someone's going to hold the door for the person behind them, either the person in front of you or you will hold for the person behind you. And that's just a very simple, mundane example of how we care for each other. And so once you begin to see it manifest around you from others, I think it makes it a lot more easy to accept it and accept the kindness. You see, it's a natural expression of our innate, you know, basic goodness. And so once you see that it's so innate, that it's so natural, that it's, you know, it's in everybody, how can you not be open to it? That's the point I'm making. Yeah.
Wonderful. So we have about 15 minutes left, and I just wanted to invite people to continue to raise their hand if you have live questions. And in the meantime, we have some other general practice questions that have been submitted. And I'll ask for Ginny's first, and she says, what to do with an impression of so what during or after the meditation on emptiness is spontaneous presence?
Go for it, Adam. It sounds like you have a response.
You know, I think it's natural that sometimes, you know, these teachings and our practice, it's kind of like, you know, ho-hum, it's ordinary. And we say, so what? I mean, I'm not quite, you know, so if that's where the so what comes from, that we, you know, do these practices and you know, we get it on some level, but it just seems kind of, you know, there's a bleh or whatever. I think that's okay. That's what happens. But if it's that you, if the so what is like you really don't understand how emptiness is spontaneous presence, well, then I think you just need to go back and, you know, get the teachings again or listen to the audio if you got a copy of it. And slowly over time, it'll be more and more clear. I mean, there's a reason why the nature of mind teachings in Mahamudra are so systematically laid out over those four pointing outs. You know, it's very systematic the way it deals with emptiness and clarity, the way it deals with the self-luminous and the other luminous aspect of the mind. This is the third pointing out, is definitely now getting more into the working with appearance and working with the clarity aspect of the mind. And sometimes, so what? It's okay. So what? That's, you know, and being honest with yourself that today I'm so what? You know, was I expecting a wow? Was I expecting a big deal? You know, let go of the expectation or the disappointment that I don't get it today or whatever the so what's about. You know, just what our practice is to be with what is.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a question from Lewis. He says, should analytical meditation, who am I, be practiced separately from Nectar of the Path or included in it? And then he also added, how to be sure we're in the natural, ordinary state?
Yeah, so that practice can be included within Nectar of the Path. It doesn't need to be done separately. And we do that when we come to the main practice part. And that's another beauty of this this particular liturgy, is that it's in that part that we can include any practice that we're working with. But that's where you would include it. And how can we be sure we're in the natural, ordinary state? This is the question that can drive us crazy. And, you know, it really comes from, you know, it can come from a way of wanting to benefit from our practice, but it also really comes out of our bringing our dualistic mind to our practice, because it's the dualistic mind that will keep asking this. And so what really happens as we practice this is, as we can, to be letting go of that question. It's like you get the instruction, follow the instruction as best you can, and trust in that. And where you need clarification, where questions arise, you can ask the questions. And we can ask those questions in our own mind first. But that the trust is really important, because in essence, it's so simple that we keep making it harder, and so much of the questioning we do just comes out of the dualistic mind. I won't say just, because the dualistic mind has been pretty impactful in our lives. And so, you know, this sense of being able to relax and let be, and just, you know, be with
how it is right now is really important. And so then, you know, as we practice, it's not uncommon. Is this ordinary mind? Is this nature of mind? And, you know, that already is back if we're identifying with that in dualistic mind. And so we can't satisfy dualistic mind in a certain way, but we can develop confidence. And that confidence comes through, you know, our just staying with this practice, allowing it to unfold. And, you know, Mingyur Rinpoche says over and over again that, you know, it doesn't matter if it's nature of mind or shamatha, you know, that once we've had these instructions, then it will clarify. So we just have to keep turning up, keep following the instruction, looking, resting.
Thank you. Very clear. And there have been a couple of questions about doing personal practice, a personal retreat. And so Janice just wrote in, please discuss how to do a personal retreat day. What do we do between practice sessions, and how do we expand the practice session from 30 minutes to 1 or 1.5 hours?
So Yosh and I just had the good fortune to go and do a self-retreat for each. We're at the same place, but we saw very little of each other for a month. You know, on the assumption that you've been to retreats with Mingyur Rinpoche, like we have here every year at St. Thomas, St. John's, or in Europe, and you'll notice that it's kind of broken up into 6 sessions. There's a practice session before breakfast. There's 2 sessions between breakfast and lunch, 2 sessions between lunch and dinner, and 1 after dinner. I find that to be a really good daily formula. You know, they can be of varying lengths, an hour and a half each session, depending on how much time you have or what else you're doing. One of the things that we also do here at Mingyur Rinpoche's retreats is that we break those hour or hour and a half sessions into 30-minute sessions and just take a stretch break in between. Mingyur Rinpoche really, really emphasizes take a break. It freshens the practice. And from my own experience, you know, I came up through the school was you sat for as long as you could, but I've really, really find immense benefit in my practice from, you know, taking those breaks. And even if you just walk around a little bit or do some stretching exercises, it doesn't need to be aerobic or physical, you know, activity, but some stretching, some yoga, whatever sort of exercises you might have, even if you need to go to the bathroom, go to the toilet, get a drink of water, whatever. Don't make them too long. Keep them less than 5 minutes. So that's the sessions, and you know you can put together. Of course, if it's 6.5-hour sessions, what's that? We're talking 9 hours a day. So if you do a little bit less, it can be less, but somewhere between 7 and 10 hours, you can easily do. In sessions like that, if you've got nothing else happening. And then meals, of course. So, you know, mindfully prepare yourself breakfast, lunch, and dinner, whatever. You know, it's not formal practice, but it's post-meditation. It's infused with mindfulness, stillness, awareness that carries over from your practice sessions. And you may wish to read some Dhamma books. And there are 3 different types of Dhamma books that I find, you know, they could be audio teachings that you might have from your teacher from retreats. And I find there are 3 different topics that I find really helpful to tap in when I'm on a self-retreat. One is teachings that are about the practice, whether it's teaching whatever we're doing pertinent to Nectar of the Path or Nundro or Nature of Mind that you might get from either a book or from a teacher. The other stuff, I really love the Abhidhamma, you know, like we're doing the 4 philosophical schools in Vajrayana Online at the moment, exploring reality. I really love that sort of stuff. So I often infuse myself with a dose of that And then the third thing, which I think is really helpful on retreat, is some sort of biographical material. You know, there's so many great books out there about the giants of the lineage. And there's various styles. You know, the more classical style from the Tibetan style is very, you know, lots of hyperbole and lots of, you know, inspiration, amazing stories. And then there are some contemporary ones, you know, like the books that were written about, like Blazing Splendor, the memoirs of Tugluvian Rinpoche, Enlightened Vagabond, the book that Matthew Ricard published last year from Patril Rinpoche's, you know, stories from Patril Rinpoche. And those sorts of books I find very inspiring. They really are, they're inspiring to continue with the practice because you read the stories of these people, you know, and there are also some books out there from women practitioners. Yoshin might remember who they are more than I do, but what I find so it's so conducive to engendering faith and confidence in your practice. You know, you may kind of feel like that these persons, you know, there's no way I could spend 30 years in a cave, but at least I'm spending 30 minutes on the cushion. And for that reason, it's really, you know, inspiring. So I don't know if that really answered the question.
Well, I'll just add to that a little bit. I think in the back of each of the guidebooks, it has different schedules that one might use on retreat. And so that can give you different time breakdowns. And with that, what I would like to say is I think when you're moving into personal retreat, it's really important to practice in a way that isn't so threatening or pushes you so hard that you never ever want to do personal retreat again. And, you know, as Edwin outlined, a schedule can really support us, and yet don't get too tight with it. You know, personal retreats can be a time where we explore our own rhythm. And of course, we don't want that to be, oh, I'm a little bit tired, I think I should rest now. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. But, you know, it is like if it's been, we've been maybe gone to these retreats and it's been a huge stretch to do the hour and a half sessions, that maybe we find that, you know, doing hour long sessions is what works for us. And then in between, you know, we can do things like stretching, we can include walking, you know, that it's not like we abandon our practice completely, but we find what helps us to stay balanced, to be able to stay with awareness. So there is a piece in here too, where I think you really want to respect yourself in how you do this. And that, you know, if you're doing it for a day on your own, you know, you can experiment with different time lengths. And of course, it isn't that we just want to sit and then when things get going hard, decide, well, that's enough. You know, that's not helpful. And that's where schedules really do help, because we're sitting with something, but we know there is a shift going to happen at some point. But don't push too hard with this. You know, so respect yourself within the process. Because actually, you know, for me, I completely love doing personal retreats because I can follow my own rhythm, and that it's really rich just to be sitting there, you and your mind, and not a lot of other input. So it's very valuable to do. So I really would encourage you to explore this in a way that maybe it becomes a regular part of your life. And if you do have further questions, please contact us.
Thank you. We have about 3 or 4 minutes left, and we still have quite a few questions to go through. I would just want to ask Zangmo's question. She said, last summer in France, Rinpoche said, nature of mind is unchanging but not permanent. Please clarify the difference.
Okay.
3 minutes.
I think the really helpful thing that I have heard Rinpoche say is that it's not permanent and it's not impermanent. It is beyond concepts. And so any concept of permanence or impermanence is not transcendent of concepts. Yes, and because we're now into the realm of the ineffable, anything I say would be just a concept. That's a very convenient way to get off the hook.
Yeah, my answer would be similar. You know, things themselves are permanent and impermanent, and this is I think this is a wonderful place of personal inquiry.
Yes.
So I'm going to unmute Margaret St. John. Go ahead, Margaret.
Hi, I waited till the end to put my hand up because this is a little silly and I thought perhaps Edwin would get to it anyway. If you found Rinpoche's handwritten notes on this practice, would you hold it up and just show us? It's like it's like a precious treasure.
I agree. And I feel so blessed to actually be the custodian. I just hope that I haven't lost it now that I promised that it's here.
It could be next time.
I'd have to, root around in there. I don't, I know it's in there. I saw it not that long ago.
Another time just to call to the Rinpoche from the call to the guru from afar.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. You know, there's something else I just really want to say. So, there's this lineage of Tertons, of treasure revealers. And, they reveal the scripts in various ways. And when they're translated into texts, they use specific punctuation, a couple of dots at the end of the lines that denotes that it's a terma, that it's a revealed treasure teaching. And when Rinpoche produced this, he gave it to Kempo Kunga for him to, because it's just in the ordinary script, to transliterate it into the traditional Tibetan typeface so that Cortland could then translate it, because Cortland can't read the handwritten Tibetan. And he asked Mingyur Rinpoche, Kempo Kunga was so impressed with the quality of the prose, and Kempo Kunga is known for his, as a Kempo, for his study of Tibetan prose and his oratory and so forth. And he was so impressed with Mingyur Rinpoche's writing, he asked him, should it have the dots that would distinguish it as a terma? And of course, Mingyur Rinpoche said, no. But it's just a little anecdote that gives me a great appreciation for what this text is.
So we're at the top of the hour. I'm wondering if we have time for one more question.
Okay, with me.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And if people have to go, please do.
Okay. Elena asks, what's the difference between the stillness that we notice in the stillness in movement practice and the stillness in shamatha?
That's for you, Myoshin.
So they're both stillness. Stillness is stillness. But within the stillness, movement, and awareness, we're looking towards the nature of that stillness. So it's just... that it brings in the wisdom element of seeing stillness in its nature.
Well, thank you so much, Edwin and Myoshin, for this incredibly valuable opportunity for us to ask our questions about practice. You've done such a beautiful job shedding light on all of these questions. Max will definitely be posting the recording of this for anyone to listen to again, or for those who missed it, they can listen to it. And again, I posted the level 2 Nectar of the Path practice instructions in the chat box. You can follow that link to get that. And do you have any concluding words, Edwin and Myoshin?
Oh. Edwin's looking for Nectar of the Path.
So, just in closing, I would say, having just come out of retreat, what I feel is gratitude, and that we have this path, we have these practices,
And I feel like that this is what we can do in the world and bringing our practice out into the world as well. You know, just our own endeavor to awaken for the benefit of all beings. There we have it.
Best Western nectar of the path.
I just took a screenshot.
There it is in Mingle Rinpoche's handwritten words on a best Western note.
Wow. That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, precious. Each Best Western hotel is independently owned and operated.
And thank you, Diane.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Diane. Appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for joining us. And, you know, we are so fortunate within the Turgar community to have this Nectar of the Path. It is so personally, uniquely Mingo Rinpoche in its style and so on, and so steeped in the tradition. And in many ways, I feel like it's one of the gems that we have in our path of liberation that keeps us all connected as a Sangha, as a community, to be able to do this together is really precious. So thank you all for your practice.
Lots of thank yous are coming in, but love Max's comment. Best Western, it's Amitabha's Pure Land. So on that note, goodbye, everybody.
Thank you all. See you later.